Being a contactee myself, it's an...
You've got to listen to ICAR. That's International Community for Alien Research. www.icar1.com. I should know. I'm Irish.
Certainly could.
Live anyway.
Uh-oh.
I'm kidding.
Well, if they type it in.
Are you interested in a radio program that focuses on the deeper aspects of the UFO topic? Would you like to explore the facts and truths of what ufology and UFO research are all about? And please join us here every Saturday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central for Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, with your host, D. Andrew, right here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. And remember, UFO research is not a belief system.
To UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
I had had enough.
Well, you drove out there into the middle of nowhere and had some sort of loud verbal display challenging E.T. in general out in the middle of nowhere.
That's what I was doing. I actually... had a pistol in my hand at the time. I was really ticked off. When I was having this fit, I was waving the gun in the air, okay, and I had this fit. And at this moment, I said, okay.
Was a Louisiana man named Montaldo. Folks around called him Six Gun Joe. Works with ICAR, don't you know? Investigating UFOs. Out for a drive with a gal one night, they stopped to check out a reporting site. When an alien lit right there on the ground, commenced to throw in his weight around. Now, old Six Gun didn't take too kindly to that kind of thing. Especially without Vaseline or anything like that, you know. Seriously. Well, Six Gun looked that critter right in the eye and said, any last wish before you die, y'all? Reached for his gun, quick as a twitch, and said, fill your claw, you son of a bitch. Now, a legend spread across the land about this pistol-waving man. But if you're from space or from Earth below, you don't give no lip to Six Gun Joe.
Welcome to UFO Undercover with your host, Joe Montaldo.
Good evening, everyone. I hope everyone's having a great evening, a great morning, a great afternoon, wherever they are on their beautiful blue planet. Guys, you know, this is part of our contactee special we've been doing. This is actually the third show. In the contactee, there was Dallas Sims and Karina Sables, and Helen Sanderson's going to be on with us in a few minutes, and I'm going to bring her on. A couple of things right quick, guys. All of these archives are available at www.paranormalradionetwork.org. That is always where the archives are located. Anything that might not be there, if it's something that is now listed as a pay-for-listen, it'll actually be listed over at blackvault.com, BBRN site, John Greenwald site, it's over there. But there's a link off of the main ParanormalRadioNetwork.com site. You can find it there. Also, the panel shows are going to be pay for listen because, you know, the station needs to pay its bills. So we're going to, those shows will all be pay for listen, but everything else will actually be free and available for anybody who wants to listen to it via the archive site. You know, the archives do really good. See, Karina Sables has already had about 10,000 downloads and about 700 plays, so it's a little archive is doing quite well. Helen is someone I've been talking to on and off on Facebook now for, I guess about 2 years, I think. Somewhere right around there.
It's been like a year.
Yeah, well, we're not going to be in perfect numbers here. But anyway, Helen, let me go ahead and introduce you to the audience, and I want you to tell the audience a little bit about yourself, whatever you feel comfortable with, and then we'll go from there. So go ahead, Helen.
Sure, okay. Thanks, Jay. And, well, first of all, it really is nice to talk to you because just typing, and, you know, we neither of us like typing all that much. Just to put,
I feel for you for having to read my typing, by the way. But go ahead, finish.
It's got a distinct Spanish accent to it. It's very entertaining. I love it. But, yeah, no, thank you for asking me to do this. It's not often we get a chance to be properly heard, you know, so I'm very grateful. Thank you, and to Bill, for setting this up. Nice one.
Yeah.
Well, I don't really know where you want me to start. Can I start at the beginning?
Well, you know, what you feel comfortable with, because I know, you know, we're, this is radio, and fortunately nobody can see our faces. You know, it's funny, Helen, because when I first started talking about my own experiences, I used to get kind of flush in the face. I was kind of grateful that we were on the radio and not on TV or anything.
Yes,
anybody could see me. Because I'm also, I get fidgety on some shows too. It look kind of funny on TV. But it just start with, well, let's do this. Let's start with what's the earliest recollection you have of contact? How young were you?
Oh, I don't have any recollection of contact at all until I was 27.
Okay.
And then I was taken in a very dramatic way, so there was no avoiding recognition then. But I must admit, I had a really strange, lots of strange things going on when I was a child, which I now do connect with the experience, but I didn't then. I didn't put it together at all. I mean, for the first really significant thing, I think, is that up until the age of about 13, I tended to have a lot of repeat dreams that were, well, some of them just weren't on this planet at all. They were very vivid. They were always in colour, and I could see myself clearly on this other planet, and I knew it was another planet because the skies were different. They were sort of swirly, you know, a bit like a kind of Mercury effect, and there were touches of yellow, gold, pink in the sky. It was completely different to ours anyway, and going underground there, and I never saw any beings, but I knew I was on another planet.
Let me get you stopped there for 1 second. When you knew you were on the other planet, because I know you're kind of young in the dream here, sense of feeling, I mean, what was it? Fear, exhilaration, love, peace, hate?
No, just being at home. Just being at home as if it was my home. But I didn't really, this was very young, Joe. You know, from when I was a baby, I had started having really vivid dreams from when I was tiny. And so I didn't have the wherewithal to check with other people then, is this normal? I just assumed everybody had strange dreams. And later, as I got a little older, I did hear people discussing dreams, you know, something fantastic happened. And I thought, oh, that's normal then. It's normal to dream about things that don't really happen in everyday life. But then when I was 8, I started having dreams about this life in a place in Somalia, which I was very clear about as well. I could sort of see everything that was going on, and I was lucid dreaming a lot of the time, so that I knew that I was me, but I also knew that I was this man who was a sort of sultan in a place called Takht-i-Suleiman. And I could see my family, and there was a temple nearby, and often men used to go in there and pray, and this place that we lived in, it's still, well, there's the remains of a place there now. It's one of the kind of fairly famous place in Iran, and it's next to what they say is a bottomless lake. But in actual fact, I believe that that lake used to be in another place. It just closed over at one point and popped up somewhere else. So what's going on under the landscape there, I don't know. But, yeah, very, very clear dreams about this. And there was a sort of throne room, a lot of gold. It was big pillars inside this palace, I suppose you'd call it. And it was nothing like I was at Silver Harem in this place as well. And I couldn't really have got this information from anywhere else because we didn't even have a television then. You know, I was completely unfamiliar with the whole concept of reincarnation. I now realise that, you know, both these lives that I was dreaming about, but fairly continuously, not frequently, but enough for it to be a continuous thing, were actually other lives of mine. So I've had confirmation of this in many ways since. So yes, that was the first thing that was strange about my life.
Well, I can understand that. I mean, it's strange. You know, when I was a kid, because I didn't know I had any contact until I was almost 30 years old, but when I was a kid, I knew something was going on, but I really didn't know what it was. Man, I used to have these wicked dreams at 7 and 8 years old. I actually taught myself how to dream so I could stop dreaming about these guys. And I didn't find out too much later on to what they were. And they weren't hurting me or anything. It's just, you know, I guess the actual shock of seeing them up close and personal at that age was kind of freaky weird in my subconscious. But, when I talk to contactees, that's why I like to ask them, you know, what they remember. Because now, from puberty up through your 20s, because I don't want to give away your age. It's never polite to ask a woman her age, so we're not going to go there.
I don't mind anyway.
Well, I know, but it's just not that. And as a lot of women in my family would be smacking my butt around. the thing about it is what do you now? Wait, let me slow down here. I don't want to get us too far ahead, but in this period, I know there's a lot of activity goes on in a contactee/abductee's life. For you, because you were talking 27 for real recollection, so you were an abductee prior to that and, you know, contactee after that. But
now this is something I'd really like to clear up with you, sir, if you've got a minute or two, because I've realized from being on Facebook for this last year that there's a lot of difference and confusion, even. It causes confusion that these different terms are interpreted differently in the States than they are over here, I think. Because as far as I'm concerned, an abductee is somebody who's got an implant, and they may or may not, you know, recall how it got there and remember procedures. But that's the defining point for being an abductee to me, anyway. But you have an implant, because if they're collecting you and fetching you backwards and forwards to wherever, they have to be able to find you, and they're only little, you know, transmitter receiver devices. So there you go. You've got Daryl Sims and Roger Lear, haven't you? You've got, you know, maybe collections of them.
Well, we had to change it because we found early on that very few contactees have implants. Mill labs have implants. Contactees rarely have implants. They're actually far and few between. We're at about 15,000 cases right now. I think maybe 500 have had implants. The majority of them just don't.
How do you know that?
Well, because ET doesn't need an implant to track you. They track you through your DNA. They don't need. Matter of fact, the U.S. government's working on that very project right now, tracking you through your DNA. They don't need a physical implant to find you. They don't need a physical implant to contact you, but the military does. They need a physical implant to keep in tabs with you and to know where you are. ET hasn't needed that for a very, very long time. Their technology far exceeds ours. And since they abduct in family lines, they identify you through your family line. They know your DNA back probably 10,000 or more years. So they're quite familiar with it, and they understand it quite well, and they know how to find you quite easily. So for us, we had to change it. We had to change it. Abductee for us means anyone who hasn't had an awakening experience. The people like are just having dreams. Yeah, see, for us, a contactee is someone who is consciously aware of their contact. Anything before that is an abductee because they're not willing participants. They don't understand what's going on to them, and they really don't have a clue what it is that's happening in their life. So we categorize them as an abductee, and anybody who's had the awakening experience, like you and others that we both know, well, those are definitely contactees. And then there's still stages up from contactee. But it's tough for us because, you know, we see so many contactees that it gives us kind of a clear view on a lot of the what I like to call the basics, because there's a lot of other stuff in there that's going to differ from, you know, person to person to person to person. But there's a fundamental basics to almost all abductions, which is what ICAR uses for abduction criteria. Yeah, we've been doing this a long, long time, as you can tell.
Okay, yeah.
But now, see, now you understand. But now you understand what I'm talking about when I'm yapping.
Yeah, I do. But I have to kind of like say that I don't see myself in that way, because I've really been very undercover myself and not inquired as to what's going on around the world very much, apart from this last year on Facebook, and that's been an eye opener, yeah. You know. How can we put this? Do you then have a lot of investigative procedures that people are allowed to have CAT scans, or are they over there? They're allowed to have these scans that allow their body to be completely to be X-rayed. You have that over there in the States, do you? Because we don't have that here.
Y'all don't have full scans, MRIs?
Oh, we do, but I mean, they don't allow, you know.
Oh, yeah, just for the sake of doing it, yeah.
I've got to see, and can you just whip me through your machine to check? Because as far as I'm concerned, that's the only way to be absolutely 100% sure. Because my understanding and what I've been told is that anyone who is taken either by the ETs or by the military have got to have these little devices in them, and there's no way of knowing exactly where they are. I know some people that are pickled in them, you know, that have 5 or 6 or 7. Some of them are clearly visible just under the skin, you know, perhaps in an arm, and lots of people report having tinnitus or buzzing noises in their ear. And nosebleeds, which my daughter, because my daughter is also an abductee, and she tells me that, she knows, and I've heard other abductees saying this as well, Joe, that they kind of know, we know roughly when we're going to be picked up next, because we'll get this ringing noise in our ear or a nosebleed. And these are signals being sent transmitted through these implants. That's what's causing the nosebleeds and causing the noises in the ear. But you wouldn't agree with that.
Well, we don't even get nosebleeds anymore. That's a rare phenomenon amongst the contactee now. There's a lot of stuff that used to happen to contactees in the 60s and 70s that doesn't happen anymore, like missing time. 99% of all of our contactees don't even experience missing time anymore. They're not getting cover memories. They're getting feedback loops. ET has gotten very advanced in the last 2 decades in the way they do things, and they have changed the way they do things significantly, and they've changed it because of the researchers. Too many researchers were getting too close to what they were doing, so they started changing the way they do procedures. The grays, you're not going to find grays with missing time anymore. You're going to find them with gain time or even time. You're just not going to find the missing time syndrome like you used to.
That's very true, actually.
Yeah, and then they do the feedback memories, which are what they do is they clip a piece of your memory, something that is mundane in your life, something that you do daily, or, you know, often, something that you're not going to question because you do it so much. They'll take that,
yeah,
and whatever missing time they have, they'll loop those memories over it. As far as you're concerned, you don't even know you missed any time. The only reason people find out anymore is occasionally they make a mistake, and they put the wrong memory in, or they mess up with the time. But usually they're pretty seamless. But, you know, we've had several contactees that have had complete MRIs, tip to head toe. And actually, down here, if you've got the $2,500, you can just go have one yourself. They'll do it for you just to do it, I guess, you know. Americans get paranoid about being sick, I guess. I guess they don't really care, but yeah, I know a few of them that have had them done, and they're not turning up anything. And then to top it all off, you know, we program contactees to ask questions. You know, we'll take like 100 contactees or 50 contactees and program them all with the same question. Do grays use implants? You know, a simple question. Things like that. And you know, we learn more and more, so it's interesting for us, and that's why, like, we're doing these 18 panel shows is so that each contactee can tell us, and then we can go back and see what's similar, what's not similar, which one's standing where, and why. You know, because our goal is to find out exactly what ET wants and why there is so much difference between the, if you put 10 contactees in a room, the base of their contacts will be almost identical. Everything else will be completely and totally different. Well, since there are millions and millions of contactees, not everybody can be right. So it's really important for us to find out who actually is and who actually isn't. Because all the contactees think they're right, no matter what. You're not going to even ever change their mind about that. And it's not our job to even attempt that. It's not what we do. What we're doing is finding out which one of those is actually the ones, because you'll start finding similarities from different contactees. Different things and what they're talking about will end up being similar. So we can find some truths. And there's always going to be stuff that we just go, what the mm-mm is going on here? You know? There's always going to be
exactly.
That.
Well,
and see, listen where you
might
go.
You might have to redefine the terms for me, Joe, because I've never had anything to do with the military. The military has never come into my experiences whatsoever.
Really?
And yet, I was taken in a very public and traumatic way the first time that I have any recall of. Well, obviously now I think they must have had some input in my life all along because of all the strange dreams and other strange things that happened to me when I was, you know, periodic intervals as I was growing up. You know, when I was 16, I had a six-month bout of Leider syndrome. Where everywhere I went, I'd be affecting electrical gadgets. You know, I'd go into a pub and the jukebox would jump and put another record on. And if I went into friends' houses, the same thing would happen with their stereo. And weirder things than that, so the tape would start playing backwards, or the person whose system it was couldn't even fix it until I left the room. I'd walk under lamp posts and they'd turn off or on, depending on which they were, you know, lots of incidences of that. And I had another repeat bout of that when I was 19. And being able to read people's minds, telekinesis. I remember an incident when I was about, how old would I have been? But, 12, maybe 13, something like that. But we were playing with the Van de Graaff generators in physics. And when I touched it, these enormous sparks came out and kind of went into my hand. And then I was going around electrocuting everybody else for the rest of the day. Every time I came near anybody, these sparks were shooting out the end of my fingers when I was electrocuting everybody.
No, I've heard this before. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
It was scary to me. You know, in fact, I asked her to give up physics. I was so traumatized by it at the time. I'm very nervous of electricity after that as well. Didn't like to sort of change plugs or, you know, pull out a lead at the wrong end or anything like that.
Well, contactees are prone to electrocuting things and destroying electronics and killing cars and computers and God knows what else. There is a thing. It works for some contactees. If by some miracle you can remember, you know, like if you were taking a night before or doing a day, if you can remember, they say get those they're called static straps, and you put them on your hand and you connect them to something metal, and they say it'll drain most of that out of you. Now, it works for me because I used to blow computers up like you wouldn't believe, and right now I'm sitting there six of them, seven of them around me right now running. And they usually run pretty damn good, knock on wood, before we blow something up. But I do that. I ground myself out now. Yeah, I have to ground myself out. See, and that's another thing. When I meet a contactee like yourself, sometimes when I reach out to shake the hand, there's almost always an electrical charge. Almost always. It's just weird.
Well, Jay, we've got to stay away from each other. Well, I'm hoping to get to America, you know, before Christmas, but, like, you know.
Don't be electrocuting people, girl.
They're blowing each other up.
They frown that stuff and it's sticky. I want to back up here for a minute because I want to ask you, because you were talking about your daughter earlier, and as a contactee with children myself, knowing they're being contacted. How did you feel about this? I mean, you know, you personally know some of the stuff that goes on in these contacts. You know, a lot of times it's easy going stuff that's not, you know, it really doesn't harm us anyway, but occasionally they do stuff that is intrusive. And a lot of times you don't remember it, but for you, how was it? I mean, when you realized, were you okay with they were taking the kids, or did you have any resentment?
No, I was very, very shocked. I was really shocked. But you see, the thing with my daughter is I've got two children, and the one I am reasonably sure, and also my family, you know, my parents, the rest of my family, I am pretty sure that they've got no or have no knowledge of anything and weren't in fact being taken. But I think we are still going to have difficulties with this terminology, Joe, because when I was taken, it was kind of out in the open, in public, and perhaps I could just tell you about that so you will get the gist of, because I went into such a terrible state of post-traumatic shock after this happened that I basically didn't come out of my shell, really, for well gone a decade. You know, I think it took me 8 years before I could articulate well enough to somebody that was going to listen that I could tell anybody without breaking down. I would just start sobbing and shaking, and because I knew nobody was going to believe me. It was just so unbelievable. But I know what happened to me, and I've luckily had evidence. I had the proof of what happened to me, if you like, because I'll tell you the story because it compromises my credibility as far as I'm concerned, Joe. That it was just before the Rendlesham Forest incident, so like a day or two before that, Christmas Eve 1980, and the 2 years previous to that, I'd had an accident happen to me both Christmases. The first Christmas I had a riding accident where the horse I was on bolted off and jackknifed, and apparently it was really funny to watch. I didn't find it funny at the time, but I was thrown straight up into the air and did a bit of a little cartwheel and came down and luckily landed on the verge, you know, on the grass. But I borrowed my friend's riding hat and they were out with me, and it was too big. My friend's riding hat was too big, so I'd just taken it off. And this is what caused the horse to bolt, actually. I've just taken it off and handed it down to my friend's husband, said, "Oh, I can do without this," famous last words. The horse shut off. And so I was laid up all over Christmas that year, 1978, with a very, very stiff neck. And then the following Christmas Eve again, I was at a party with friends and given a lift back on a really tasty Harley Davidson, but a peculiar thing happened as we were going around this big main, you know, city roundabout. There was no ice, there was no wind, nothing, but the whole bike got lifted up off the off the road and thrown against these railings, and I broke my arm, so I was laid up over Christmas then. And this is all on my doctor's notes, you know. So the following year, because they say things happen in threes, and I was, for some reason, as I now understand, you know, my intuition is picking up on, but I was really, really nervous about going anywhere. Normally I went to visit my parents, I nearly always went to visit my parents at Christmas, and I phoned them and I said, look, do you mind if I don't come this year? I want to stay indoors or just stay somewhere close. I don't want any risk of any accidents. That was fine. And I decided to go and visit and stay with a couple of friends in Bristol, which is where I was living at the time. And being Christmas Eve, they decided to take some magic mushrooms, and I'd tried those before, but also quite a nice time, actually, in season. It's quite standard over here because they grow over here, you know. And but they wanted to make a massive, great big pot of tea with them, and I wasn't prepared to do that because it was fasting. And I'd only ever eaten, you know, 15, something like that. That's kind of a small amount, really, if you're used to them. So I knew that I didn't have any allergies to them or any funny reactions to them, even though I'd had some interesting things happen. You know, it was never anything that bothered me. And so I refused this. We'd had a couple of splits, and we'd had some beer, some lager, but nothing excessive, you know, just a couple of pints. And then it started snowing outside, and I thought it was really pretty, and I sort of said, oh, I'd like to go out, and, you know, anybody wants to come. But they'd had all, you know, this pot of tea. And to keep them company, I'd actually eaten four, which would do nothing for somebody that was kind of used to them, do you know what I mean? In fact, I didn't really get any effects off them at all, other than, you know, very slight. I could feel a very, very slight, mild effect, but nothing to speak of, you know. And so I decided to go out myself. There were quite a few people out in the street because it was, we looked at the time before I left. I couldn't see the clock, so I asked my friend, what time is it? And it was 25 to midnight. They pointed out the clock to me, and I looked at it. All three of us looked at the clock. And I went down the doors, and as far as I was concerned, I was just going to walk around the block, admire the view because it was up on a high hill, look at the snow, and go back in. I wasn't expecting to be any longer than about sort of 10, 15 minutes. So I left the door on the nib, and started walking up this hill opposite, and there were eight other people in the street as well as I was walking up. And I got to the top, and there were two men passing one way at the T junction at the top, and another coming in the other direction. And a cat on the wall. I can still, this is the one thing that I can remember clearer than anything else in my life. Even though it's like 30 years ago, I can remember it so clearly, because as I got to the top to prevent me getting in the way of these three people passing on the pavement at the top, I stopped just short of the pavement and turned around to look at the view. And the next thing I knew, there was this massive, absolutely massive beam of light came down. I'd say it was probably a good 100 feet or more across, and it encompassed everybody that was in the street. And I suddenly found that I was paralyzed. I couldn't move at all. I can remember my chin actually dropped to my chest, so I was straining to try and look up and see, but because I was above the people on the hill that I just passed coming up this little short bit of hill, I could see them really clearly, and I seemed to be the only one that was still conscious. My eyes were wide open, but the rest of my body was completely paralyzed, and in the end I couldn't even force my eyes up any longer. But before my vision dropped down to my feet, which were dangling off the ground, I could see that there was about 6 inches between the tips of my toes and the ground. I also noticed that there were separate tubes, separate beams of light, smaller ones. Each one has encompassed these other eight people. Well, I presume the three behind me, because I had my back turned to these three men that were crossing behind me by this point. And the beam, this is the thing, the beam of light went into the houses behind me as well. So I don't know how that affected people in the houses, but I know how I could see how it was affecting these other people, because they'd all gone limp and paralyzed like me, and they were in their own separate tubes of light, eyes closed, just hanging like me, just dangling there. And I started to kind of like ride really, really quickly so that I could see the whole of this hill and the view out over Bristol, which is where we were. And then the part of the planet, and then it was gone. And the next thing I knew, it was all going into reverse. And I ended up back on the same spot, and I knew immediately what had happened to me. There was never any doubt in my mind what had happened to me. But it was unbelievable. So I ran back down to the house where I'd left my friends. I felt so sorry for them, though, because they've had all these magic mushrooms, you know, it's like holiday time. And that's what they've chosen to do, and I couldn't get them to kind of like take on board. And the first thing I said to them as I came back in, I was sort of really flushed and sort of anxious. I said, I think I've just been taken up by a UFO. And they just stared at me, you know, and I tried to get them to go down, and it was at this point I asked them, I said, what time is it? And it was 20 past midnight. So a whole 3/4 of an hour had gone, and I'd only walked 100 yards and back. If nothing happened to me other than I'd had a hallucination at the top of this QT junction, it couldn't have taken me longer than 2-3 minutes at the outside to walk up to the top of this junction and walk back. I ran when I could like unstick myself from the pavement, because I still felt immobilized as if I was standing and chewing gum when I came back, and very disorientated, you know, but also really, really clear about what had happened. And they came, and one of them came down to the door with me, and one of the there was an elderly gentleman who was one of the ones that I'd passed on this little bit of hill. He'd been talking to a friend over his garden gate. He was still there, and he was he had his head in his hands. He was just shaking his head backwards and forwards, and I thought, I know why, because he was one of the ones that I saw had been encapsulated in these smaller beams of light. And he just looked so shocked, and I tried to wave to him. He was just shaking his head, and he sort of looked up at one point and gave me a gesture back, and I was saying to my friend, look, see, he was one of them. He knows what happened. And my friend was just saying, well, don't be silly, Helen, come back in, you know, it's Christmas Eve, of course, if you wave at somebody, they're going to wave back at you, there's nothing going on, just come in. And so I did, and I shut right up then. One of them made me a cup of tea. I thought, I'd better not say anything else, because even as I was, you know, going over it in my mind and knowing exactly what had happened to me, I could also hear how it sounded, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, man. Oh, my God. I was so shocked. I was really shocked. So I sat there for about half an hour, and then all of a sudden, I'd been, you know, my skin had been okay when I first re-entered the house, but as I looked down with this cup of tea, I could see that, you know, all of my hands, and I turned them over as well, and it was the same on my palm, were absolutely pickled with bright red spots. It was almost as if you'd like pricked me with a pin all over. It was that bright red, and the rest of the skin underneath was like chalk, very, very white. and they were under my fingernails, and I started pulling my my jumper up so that I could see my arms, and they were all up my arms. And I lifted my jumper up, and they were all over my stomach, and I looked at my feet, and they were all over my feet. At that point, I just completely freaked out. You know, I said, my God, what's this? You know, look what's happened to me. You know, I told you something had happened. And one of my friends said, well, you sometimes get spots on mushrooms, you know. And I thought, well, only if you're having an allergic reaction. And I've tried them before, and I've never had any problems with them, you know, so I'm not having an allergic reaction. And anyway, when have you ever heard of mushrooms doing this? And the thing was, by this point, they were looking at me, you know, in horror, because I'm sorry, decency or no doubt, I just stripped down to my, you know, my bra and pants at this point, because I wanted to see how far it went over my body. And, oh, a little bit stressful just recalling this, you know. One of my friends counted in 1 square inch on my skin, on my back. I had 100 of these spots, so there were literally hundreds of thousands. You can imagine the density if you've got 100 in a square inch, can't you? And they were all really clear, red, very, very defined against this chalky skin underneath. And the reason that they were giving me such peculiar looks was that it all ended in a distinct line around my neck. There's nothing on my neck, on my face at all. The rest of my body was pickled. And at that point, I knew I had to get some help. And they didn't have a phone, my friend. So, and I knew somebody vaguely, but one of them knew down the road who did have a phone. I hardly knew these people. I've only just been introduced to them. And I said, I've got to get help. I'm going to phone a doctor. And I sort of ran off down the street. And by this point, I was starting to feel very woozy, very strange. And knocked on this family's door. And the husband opened the door and took one look at me. And my God, what's happened to you, you know? I sort of broke down then, and I didn't say what I thought had happened, because I'd already seen the reaction I got from my friends. I sort of said, look, I've just come from my friends, and you know, they've had some magic mushrooms. And I said, I've had 4, so I don't know what's happening, but I need some help. They didn't really want to get involved, you know, because of the magic mushrooms, and I don't blame them, but they said, the wife was lovely. She was really lovely. She said, oh, don't worry, because I started stopping at this point, you know. She said that, I showed her, you know, my skin, and she said, oh my God, that's dreadful, you know, you need a doctor. And she said, don't worry, you know, my husband will walk you back to my friends. We'll arrange, we'll call the hospital, we'll call the surgery and get them to meet you around there. And don't worry, we won't leave you. My husband will walk you back there, make sure that you're all right. And I got back to the house with him. He dropped me off and my friends took me in. And I remember very little after that, because I was flitting in and out of consciousness by the time the doctor arrived. And he was really puzzled, and despite the fact that it was Christmas Eve, he ended up spending about 3 hours there with me. He got the whole story from my friend, and just assumed at first that it was because nobody could ask me how many I'd had of these mushrooms. They said, oh, we only saw her eat 4, but, like, you know, she ate more. I mean, we don't know. She went out for a walk, and then that was when they told the doctor what I'd said had happened. He clearly thought that apparently, because I've got no conscious recollection of this, I was virtually in a coma by this point. And he thought, well, then it could have been something external and nothing to do with the mushrooms. He said, because I must admit, having examined her, my friends had to tell me all this afterwards because I've got no recollection of it. he said now that I've examined her, he said her pulse is normal, her temperature is normal. I mean, this wouldn't really be the case if she was having an allergic reaction to something. And he said, the only thing that I've ever seen anything like this is a radiation rash. And that was the point when my friends told him the story that I'd come back with. So I think that's why he stayed longer. And he wanted to take me to hospital because he said it was so extreme. He'd never seen anything like it. He wanted to call an ambulance and have me carted off to the hospital, but he said that I will also have to call the police because you've admitted that you've been taking magic mushrooms. So, there you go. If I call for an ambulance, then I'll also have to call for police, and you will probably be prosecuted, having done willful damage to this woman.
Yes, I imagine they found on magic mushrooms in over there just like they do over here.
Yes, precisely. It's a class A or B drug or something, you know.
Well, it's interesting because around, 84, 86, somewhere around there, my wife and I were down in Gulf Breeze, Florida. And when we had an overhead sighting, now there was a lot of other stuff went on, but to make this long story short, because I don't want to get into it too much, the three of us were sitting there. My son, who's now is 25, I think was 3 at the time or 2. And when all this went on, all of her arms, all up and down, all in her body were just covered in these, blisters.
Covered in what, face?
Yeah, but her face wasn't. Face wasn't touched. And me and my son had no marks on us at all. And we were sitting right next to her. So, I don't know. It's...
Well, that was a bit of missing time then, wasn't it?
That was definitely... Well, it was so weird because this was classic, like, 1979 UFO. This thing came over the top of a sand dune. And as it was going over the top of us, we know at that moment we were gone. And then we know probably when they put us back, but... that was wild. I mean, this is typical, like something you see out of a movie. We look up here, it comes over the sand dune, like, oh no, we're going. It's wild. But stuff like that happens.
Wow. Do you not regard that as being abducted? Because obviously you were taken somewhere else, or at least part of you.
I don't know what causes the marks, but I do know that several contactees, and I'm not talking about bruises or scratches, I'm talking about where their body was covered by some kind of lines, marks, scratches, blisters, burns, what have you, whatever you want to call it. I've heard this probably, it might be 1 in 100. It's hard to put a number. I'd actually have to go sit down and look. But there are contactees that haven't, and I don't know why. I have not found any one thing. I mean, maybe something will come out in your memory one day that might be specific why it happened. Like the wind, I was there and I still don't know what happened. I'm kind of like, what the hell?
Right, okay.
Your skin's being exposed to, but what it is, I don't know.
But I knew what it was, you see, though. I mean, right from the very beginning, I knew what it was. And anyway, the arrangement that the doctor came to, in the end, it was about 4 o'clock in the morning, and he said, look, it's Christmas Day now. I'd like to be with my family, make up your mind, either because her pulse is normal and her temperature is normal and I can't work out what on earth has happened to her, if you're prepared to keep her here, it'll save you being prosecuted, which I thought was quite decent of this guy saying this. He said, if I do what my instinct is telling me to do, which is to, call the ambulance, then you're going to be prosecuted. So it's up to you. And My professional judgment is that if he isn't at any risk of dying or anything like that, so if you're prepared to look after her, then it'll be, the better for you. And if she takes a turn for the worse, then you call the ambulance and take the consequences or whatever. But by this point, I was virtually unconscious. And so they decided to keep me there. And I knew nothing about what happened subsequently, other than it seemed quite dark and like I felt very, very ill, and a few moments when I sort of briefly came to consciousness, my friends were trying to get me to drink some water, you know, assisting me, lifting my head up, you know, to get me to sip some water. I had no idea how long this went on until I started to feel a bit better and they were bringing me up cups of tea. And then I discovered that 5 days had elapsed. They've kept me there for 5 whole days and I've been unconscious virtually all the time. And they said that whenever they tried to open the curtain windows and let in the light, I just screamed. I screamed in my sleep. I couldn't stand the light because of the memory of this light that had come down on the pavement.
Mm-hmm.
And because by the time I was well enough to get up, it was the 29th. I'd lost 5 days.
Well, that's not uncommon in contact situations, so.
Well, this is why I kind of really related to Travis Walton when I heard his story, because I thought, I had no awareness of ETs. I had no interest in thinking about ETs. I never read any science fiction. I mean, we lived in Cyprus when I was younger, and it was such a beautiful country, and I'd look at all the wildlife, the insects, and the fabulous sky, and sort of think, there definitely is something else out there. You know, we're not the only, you know, conscious entities in the universe. I kind of always knew that, but I didn't have a single thought in my head about ETs. Not one. Not one.
Well, yeah, that's not that uncommon. Go ahead.
I really identified with Travis Walton in later years, because when I heard what happened to him, I still haven't heard his full story, and I'd love to. I'm going to,
you know, Jim Sparks has lost a lot of time too, like that.
Jim Sparks, yeah, and I relate to him as well.
Yeah.
I relate to him because I've had
procedures
that are done to me. You know, like you remember when he had the tar taken out of his lungs. Well, RETs did the same to me. They extracted in the same way. You know, took it out and presented these little vials, to my daughter. She helped with the operation, she's told me. And they extracted all this tar out of my lungs, because I'm a smoker now. And but you wouldn't know it. I've been smoking for 30 years, and I've got, like, you know, sort of no difficulties with my breathing. I was starting to have difficulties with my breathing until they did this to me, for me. I do regard that as a kind of a favour, if you like.
Yeah, well, I finally gave him nasty cigarettes.
We've never had anything. We've never had anything that I would describe as nasty or unkind or disturbing, other than that it was just so shocking.
Let's backtrack for a minute. I want to ask you something about those two beams of light. Actually, I want to ask you something about the big one first. When you felt, could you like feel it on your skin? Was like there an energy feel, a warmth or a heat or a cool or any kind of vibration? Or even a force? Because I hear different descriptions, and I'm really trying to pin this down to different types of fields. I'm trying to understand which ones do what. So. I mean, was there even a smell present?
No, I was immediately paralyzed, you see. So whatever sensation there might have been, all I could do was just observe through my eyes, which I couldn't even keep upright properly because of so much chin had hit my
You know, face. I still think it's freaky they let your eyes move. That still freaks me out. Go ahead, I didn't mean to interrupt you. It still freaks me out because people describe about being paralyzed, but they can move their eyes around. I'm like, that's just creepy. it's like they want you to look around.
If you can spare, you know, sort of another 3 or 4 minutes here, I will tell you the continuation of this.
Yeah,
is that I was too embarrassed to kind of discuss this with my friends who'd been listening, and I was still in a terrible state of shock, even though I'd been unconscious for 5 days, and I said I just wanted to go home. That statement was met with an equal amount of kind of like, you know, anxiety and relief on all our parts, I think, because, you know, they knew that I'd had they've been looking after me for these 5 days, so they could see what state I've been in. So they were worried about me, but they were also, it was too weird. You know, it was really too weird for them to be able to cope with. And so they called me a taxi and I went home. And that very night, I had the most vivid dream. And it was all action replay. So it was, there'd be like a little 2 minute sequence and then it would skip back again and restart exactly what had happened to me in that missing time, in that three quarters of an hour missing time. And the first thing I saw when I had this dream was that I was lying on a bench or a table, and there were five little grave seekers working away at some instrumentation beside me, and I could see down one side of my body, because again my body wouldn't work. I tried to send the signals to move my hands and move my legs, and I couldn't, so I was still technically paralyzed, but I could see just down the one side of my body that my head had fallen on. And I could see these, they were about 3 foot something, I suppose. I'm just judging this now, because as I say, I was strapped to the table, so I've got no real conception of how high the table was. But I could see their feet, sort of trying to measure them up against myself, what I could see of my body. I judged them to be about 3. And they were clones as well. There were 5 of them, and they were all practically identical. And when they moved in rhythm. One would lift up a leg and the other 4 would follow it, if you know what I mean. So they were operating as a unit and they went everywhere together. It was like having one 5 aspect unit with lots of arms and legs all moving doing the same thing. And I was very, very aware of this in my dream, what they were doing. Then they moved behind me, and I could sense, and I could intuit that they were telepathically getting a message from another being, or as I then discovered, because I was able to kind of swivel my eyeballs around slightly, and this door opened. I was in a sort of semicircular room with, you know, low light, but, you know, bright, different, like fluorescent almost. And this door opened and the light just came flooding in then, and I could see these very tall creatures that had hugely high domed heads, like really from their eyebrows, or where their eyebrows should have been, because I couldn't make out any eyebrows. In fact, they had so much light emanating off them that I couldn't really individually make out their features, other than they didn't appear to have any ears, and the area from round about where the eyebrows to the top of their head was deeper, was taller than the whole of the rest of their face. And they have very long, thin arms. And I would say they were about 7 foot tall, judging again, just making an estimation. And they walked towards me, and I could tell definitely then that they were sending some telepathic messages to the 5 feeter. And they moved around behind me, and all of a sudden my vision felt slightly more restricted. I found out later, because they told me, that they put a helmet over my head at this point. This is actually before the two tall ones came in, but I was aware that they were sending telepathic messages backwards and forwards before they came through this door. How I know that, I don't know. But so yes, I'd already had the helmet put on before they opened the door. And then they came in and they just walked, sort of glided, seemed to glide towards me. And one of them extended his middle finger towards my forehead, and that was it, I was out. I was gone. So for the next 14 months, this was an action replay that happened every single night for me, So I woke up in the beginning maybe 2-3 times a night screaming. I was screaming every time I woke up. It wouldn't go away until the end after 14 months of this without any interruption whatsoever, not even one single missed night. I couldn't take it anymore because my whole life was falling to the pit to this point. I couldn't cope with anything. I mean, even trying to move around was difficult for me because I often used to feel like my whole feet was stuck to the pavement or stuck to the floor wherever I was, and I was struggling to fight a battle against this inertia even to move, and then all of a sudden it would, like chewing gum, you know, if you get chewing gum stuck to your shoe, you know, my heel would kind of lift and I'd suck myself, you know, off enough to be able to carry on walking. But I felt as if I was in this awful state of suspended animation. Up to this point, I've had such a normal life, so I couldn't equate it. I just couldn't get used to it. I couldn't cope with it. What had been a kind of like a weekend and a recreational habit of smoking grass and having a few beers with my friends as we went down the pub, you know, nothing extreme, turned into like, you know, practically a vacation overnight. I just couldn't cope with it. So I started getting very depressed, getting very anxious. I also had horrendous panic attacks. I even went through a phase of complete agoraphobia, and I had no trace of anything weird like this in my life before, you know. Mm-hmm. I was a normal, happy, outgoing, fun-loving person, quite a lot of friends. Nothing used to feel that I quite fitted in on this planet, I must admit, or totally belonged anywhere. So that was another sign to me that there was something going on, you know, from before, perhaps even before this life, I don't know, but I had a nice, normal upbringing, very loving parents, you know, they looked after me, they loved me, they were sweethearts. I couldn't have dreamt of such a thing, you know?
Yeah.
I wouldn't have dreamt that such a thing was possible.
It's
very
it's
scary.
You know, unfortunately for contactees, it's in every walk of life. Doesn't matter what color you are, what sex you are, who your parents were. They just, you know, once they get you in their system, to say, or once they get your family in there, to say, it's always going on. And it's hard to deal. You know, when you first start remembering this, and then we got to go to break here real soon. But I know when you first start remembering this, and even as it goes on and progresses in life. You know, there's a lot of stuff to deal with. And what most people don't understand, everyday people don't understand, is the fact that a contactee has to deal with their everyday life, you know, their families, their spouses, their kids, their friends, their jobs, their careers, whatever. They got to deal with all of that, plus they have to deal with their contact. And, you know, it's one of the things we have found common in contactees. They are natural-born survivors, 99.95% of them. Or you could drop them in the middle anyway, they're going to survive. But it's hard, you know, and some of them do go over the edge, and some of them, you know, kind of flip out on us. But we're going to stop right there, Helen, because we've got to take a break. Yes, we got to take a break. Hold on 1 second. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be right back. Let me take us to a break, and I'll see y'all about 8 minutes.
You're listening to UFO Undercover with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Style that moves. Patrice Sheridan, host of A Global Focus. Broadcasts resume Friday nights from 10 to 12 Eastern on the Paranormal Radio Network. Come join the discussion.
The Church of Emmaus with hosts Jeffrey Richard and Guy Weddle. 10 p.m. Central Saturdays. Opening the gates of the underworld and calling down beings of ancient starlight. Tune in, Monster of the Apocalypse on the Paranormal Radio Network. Come to our forum at MavisIncarnate.com.
Hi, I'm Gia Scott. I'm the host of this really cool little radio program on Tuesday nights from 7 to 9 p.m. It's called The Dawn of Shades. I bring in a wide variety of guests, and we talk about all sorts of things. Some of them are authors, some of them are experiencers, but it's all paranormal. Do tune in to The Dawn of Shades from 7 to 9 p.m. Tuesdays, and you can always catch our guest list at www.gscott.com.
Light up your night with The Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
The Unabridged Universe. Join us from 7 to 9 Central Standard Time. Saturdays as host Jason Wilson and I, Victoria Rose, bring you the perspectives of guests on every topic, from extraterrestrials on the edge of the galaxy to issues that affect you right here at home. It's a big universe out there, and we're likely to cover anything. Do you have any topics that you'd like to have discussed? Know any researchers or free thinkers out there you'd like to have on the show? Log on to www.unabridgeduniverse.com and let us know, only on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, I'm psychic medium Chris George.
And I'm Stephanie Benetti.
And we're Second Sight NYC, a psychic and paranormal radio show based out of New York City.
And Chris is a psychic that tells it like it is.
So if you want something sugar-coated,
just buy a donut.
Each week we'll have an interesting guest, and I'll do psychic readings and dream interpretations with a psychic twist.
We touch on all that is paranormal, from exorcisms to ghost hunting.
From seances to passing spirits in the light.
Yeah, and sometimes Chris gets a little carried away.
But Stephanie's always there to reel me back in. We're making the unbelievable believable.
Join us.
Hi, you've got to listen to ICAR, that's International Community for Alien Research, www.icar1.com. I should know, I'm Irish.
Are you interested in a radio program that focuses on the deeper aspects of the UFO topic? Would you like to explore the facts and truths of what ufology and UFO research are all about? And please join us here every Saturday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central for Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, with your host, D. Andrew, right here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. And remember, UFO research is not a belief system.
To UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
I had had enough.
Well, you drove out there into the middle of nowhere and had some sort of loud verbal display challenging E.T. in general out in the middle of nowhere.
Oh, yeah, that's what I was doing. I actually had a pistol in my hand at the time. I was really ticked off. When I was having this fit, I was waving the gun in the air, okay, and I had this fit. And at this moment, I said, okay.
Was a Louisiana man named Montaldo. The folks around called him Six Gun Joe. Worked with ICAR, don't you know? Investigating UFOs. Out for a drive with a gal one night. They stopped to check out the reporting site. When an alien lit right there on the ground, commenced to throw and hit the weight around. Now, old sex gun didn't take too kindly to that kind of thing. But without Vaseline or anything like that, you know. Seriously. Well, Six Gun looked that critter right in the eye and said, any last wish before you die, yells. Reached for his gun, quick as a twitch, and said, fill your claw, you son of a bitch. Now, a legend spread across the land about this pistol-waving man. But if you're from space or from Earth below, you don't give no lip to Six Gun Joe.
Welcome to UFO Undercover with your host, Joe Montaldo.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome back to UFO Undercover. Like Natasha says, I am your host, Joe Montaldo. I hope everybody's enjoyed the first hour of the show. Our guest is Helen Sanderson. We're going to actually get into a couple of things because I want Helen, you know, to really feel about what she wants to talk about on here, because this really is about the contactees over the next 8, 7, or 18 weeks. I really want to get everybody just to feel comfortable and talk about what they need to talk about. And, you know, Helen and I were talking at the break about terminology around the planet. It's going to be tough to get everybody on the same page. What do you think, Helen? You think it's going to be a fight the whole way? I think so.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think they're going to resist. But it should be good because really and truly, they're, I was talking with Mike Hess a couple of days ago. He's in China, and we were discussing the directorships in China and who's going to take over and who's going to do what over there, and we were discussing terminology, you know, because for the Chinese, an abductee is someone who doesn't know they're being abducted, and a contactee is someone who, like Billy Myers, who's peace, love, and light. And they've got another term for everything in between. So I'm like, wait a minute, this is not going to work. This is going to get really confusing here really fast. So him and I were discussing, like I said, this very, very topic matter. And there is a need for a localized, but ICAR is getting to be a big organization. And then over the next couple of years, we'll break 50 or 60,000 members. So we are working on that. It's just making sure that it's done right. We don't want to leave anything out. And we want to make sure that the terminology is really, really explaining what each individual is, or as close as it can, you know, for what we're talking about. It's going to be tough. And what I'll do, too, Helen, is like people like yourself and other contactees we know, as we progress in these terms, I'll post them out to all of y'all and get everybody's feedback. And then eventually we'll get to something that everybody at least mostly agrees upon.
Well, I'm just going to be a difficult one, Joe, because I really would prefer it if you would refer to me as an abductee, and I'll tell you why, because I think that a lot of people are recognizing that they didn't have prior remembered agreements for this to happen. You know, that some, like myself, for instance, I actually believe that this was a commitment and an agreement that I made from maybe other lives now, because I've had so much explained to me, and my daughter has too. But when it first happened, I had no prior remembered contact. And back along, you know, when a lot of people were experiencing missing time and nosebleeds and all the rest of it, there were so many traumatized people because they didn't remember, they didn't recall, and I actually think this is part of the whole mind control programming, is to make us kind of minimize the thing. And even the terminology, contactee, is minimizing what's going on for people as far as I'm concerned. So just to be difficult, though, if when you refer to me to, you know, to other people, I would like it if you would call me an abductee, because that's how I see myself. And I think until we can get the measure of, you know, the extent of what's going on for people and just how much we've been hoodwinked, that to use the term contactee, it does not give the gravity to the subject that the subject needs. How can we expect people with no experience whatsoever and no knowledge and completely unawakened and no ET contact as far as they know whatsoever to understand what is happening to us, that we're being taken, we're physically being taken and we've having procedures done on us. If you use the word contactee or experience, and I see over here, I've come across people who have just seen a UFO from a distance and got no remembered incidences of anything else other than that, and they're calling themselves experiencers or contactees. Why? I don't know. You know, and people who are channeling also can call themselves contactees. So I just feel as if there ought to be like some special, maybe a new term. Perhaps we should come up with a new term altogether.
We have very strict definitions for abductees and contactees. That's just one of those things for us, because we have to distinguish between the two. It's just one of them things. And being and it's fine listening to abductees. It's just, you know, abductees for us means that you haven't gone through the awakening process. You know, if you haven't gone through the awakening process, you're an abductee. It's really a cut and dry thing. Abductees is a much more, you know, for abductees are people who really are being abducted. They're being taken against their will. They're not wanting to be part of the program, or they simply don't know they're being taken as part of the program. Abductees have very limited memory.
I've got a lot of conscious recall.
How do you know what you remember is real? How do you know it's not all a big cover memory? How do you know it's not genetic memory, which is something we find now?
They've been orchestrating what goes on for me in my life in many, many respects. We haven't got time to go into it right now, the whole bulk of it. But for instance, I'll give you a good example. How I met Nick Pope, for instance. I went for 16 years, I think, without, you know, meeting another abductee at all. I didn't meet anybody that had this type of experience. I had very, very few friends that were even prepared to talk to me about or listening to me about what had happened to me. And each time, you know, I got that opportunity, I would be shaking and sweating and sobbing just because of the sheer trauma of it all. And so that was very difficult as well, going all that length of time without another person to talk to. But in one of our local pubs, there was a notice up on a friend's music shop, you know, about a talk, you know, about the paranormal, and I decided to go along to that. And the chap who was running that is actually, you know, one of the world's most well-known cryptozoologists, Jonathan Downs. He was running this group. He just happened to live in the same town as me at the time, and I went along to this, and he came over in the break because, you know, my friend told him about me, and he said, well, what's the strangest thing that's ever happened to you? And I said, well, I doubt you've ever come across anybody that's had something weird like that happened to me. Oh, I doubt it. You know, you name it, it's I've researched it, and this is in fact true, because as soon as I told him, he was, oh, yes, I know what they get up to. I was talking to an abductee, you know, just earlier this week, you know, an elderly lady, and he said, actually, there's somebody who lives just across the park from you, literally, you know, a few hundred yards away from you, and she's been abducted. And I'll put you in touch if you like, if you would like me to give you her phone number. And this turned out to be Bridget Grant, who the minute we were introduced, we just couldn't stop talking with each other. And actually, Bree, if you're listening, my God, I tell you what, she practically saved me from going insane by this point, because I thought I was never ever going to meet anybody that had had anything similar happen to me, and she was just such a sweetheart to me, really. Filled me in on a lot of very up-to-date stuff, because she's always been very good about, like, keeping right on top of, you know, developments. conferences and knows exactly what's going on that score. And it was because, you know, partly she was friends with Nick Pope. Now, she said straight away, you know, you should get in touch with him. I could get him to, you know, if you'd like to call him, I'm sure he'd be really helpful, really interested. And I didn't want to know. I really didn't want to know. I sort of said, no, look, I'm sorry, I don't want to, because Nick was still, you know, with the MOD at the time. And I said, I'm not interested in being in contact. Nick won't mind me saying this. I know he won't mind me saying this because I've been very upfront with him too. And I told him this. You know, I did not want to be in touch with anybody who's working for what I consider to be the agency doing the covering up. Because by this point, you see, the ETs have told me an awful lot, and I knew. And I knew that the military was very, very involved, that they were covering up what was going on. So I refused to get in touch with him. And despite being saying, look, Nick's not like that, he's really nice, he's been very helpful to me, you know, he knows an awful lot, mine's all skeptic, you know, yeah, I bet he does, I'm sorry, I don't want to know, I'd rather kind of like stick to my experience and talk to people like yourself, someone that I know has had a similar experience. Well, as you said, they're not similar, they are all these very different details. And so it was 2 whole years before I got in touch with Nick. And that was only because by this point I'd read 2 of his books specifically on abduction. And by the time I'd finished those 2, I thought, oh my God, this guy actually does, you know, he is very sympathetic. He's written about them, you know, in a factual and caring way. And so I thought, he really cares. He's aware, you know, how much we're going through. He obviously knows sort of a lot about the subject if he's been able to write all this. You know, he's detailed in cases and all the rest, but he's not the kind of sympathetic feel with it. And it was at that point I said to Bridget, okay, maybe I should get in touch with this guy because he clearly is sympathetic and understands. And it was at that point that I contacted him and I said, well, look, I've been keeping notes over the years. It was a bit like writing for therapy, if you like. But I had over nearly 400 pages, full-scat pages by this point, you know, front and back, of notes that I'd written about going through the most depressive times of this, all kind of the trauma that was going on in my head, you know, smoking too much dope, trying to kind of like just obliterate it from my memory, and nothing would. It didn't, you know, glass is renowned for making you kind of like fall asleep easily and not remember your dreams. Well, it never worked like that for me. Nothing seemed to affect these dreams. It just carried on really, really vividly. Nothing stopped them, but I even had a drink problem, you name it. I tell you, I had all sorts of psychological problems from this, and I thought, well, perhaps since he has been so helpful to Bridget, that he can help me. You know, I'm going to come out of my shell a little bit more, and, you know, because she kept encouraging me to, you know, read some more. And I said, I don't want to, because I've written all about what I can remember of that, and I don't want to influence by other people's experiences, because I want to write a book about this eventually, and I want it to be just a representation of my experiences and not coloured by anybody else's. She didn't really understand that, and I didn't understand her point of view, because Nick, by this point, had offered to take her over to the States and have a request by Bud Hopkins, and I think that actually happened at one point. She was saying, you know, I'm sure something similar could happen to you. And, are you kidding? Well, my response was, are you kidding? You know, I can already remember far too much consciously. Why on earth would I want to put myself through something like that so that I can dredge out more details? You've got to be joking. You know, I really wasn't interested in that at all. I was suspicious of the whole process because by this point, you know, of course there's been lots of controversies even recently about, you know, how much is instilled into the patient, the client's mind, you know, how valid it is, how, you know, space it is, all this. So my main reason was I just didn't want to remember any more than I already could consciously, because that had had me in a state of post-traumatic shock for 13 years. So I didn't want any more dragged out of me. But in the end, I spoke with Nick, and although we kind of had this sort of tacit agreement right from the beginning, because I said to him, look, I know that there's lots that you can't tell me, Nick, because he's still under the Official Secrets Act now. I mean, once you've signed that, it's fine, isn't it? You don't ever not have that restriction on you, I think. He's no longer working for the government. He's signed those papers. So I know there's an awful lot he couldn't tell me, and from my point of view, I will never reveal what somebody else has told me about their experiences. I could only talk to him about mine, which, other than the initial details that I'm telling you now, you know, I couldn't really tell him much more either, because I wasn't aware then. I certainly became aware. I became aware. You know, the ETs have returned again, and they were making themselves more and more aware. They're making me more aware of their presence, and orchestrating things in my life so that I would go somewhere and I would see something really unusual that I wouldn't have seen if I'd been there 2 minutes earlier or 2 minutes later. You know, sort of just stopping in the middle of work sometimes and being given instructions, go to the window or go and do this now, you know, so that. And I thought, well, what are the chances if me ending up 500 yards away from, you know, the abductees, who's probably closest to, you know, our top representative in this country anyway? What are the chances of that? The very first person that I meet is a good friend of Nick Pope. And Nick has been nothing but kind and supportive and helpful to me. He's, I haven't really called on his assistance very much, but when I have, he's been right there for me. In fact, as recently as about 10 years ago, I think, I'd still not get any recognition from my doctor, despite trying to go and have my implant removed, and it spontaneously coming out days later, because I couldn't get to it. It was right up in the third eye area of my forehead, if you know, in the front of my brain, attached to the front of my brain. So up to the kind of like sinus cavity, right up there. And I know it was there, and several friends, you know, in the early days, had said to me, what is that glowing on your forehead? You've got a spot, like a bindi, you know, like Indian bindis. Just roughly that spot, right in the centre there, slightly to the left. Glowing, and four people pointed this out to me, and I see it often in the mirror. You know, I'd look in the mirror and I'd see this area of my forehead kind of glowing, and it was either a kind of a pale silvery blue or pale sort of gloomy colour against the rest of my skin. And after I had a procedure at the hospital to try and, you know, stick a probe up, you know, right up through the up my nose, they said it's not possible to put a probe up through the septum. You would need to have a serious long-term history of sinus problems if we were going to do something like that. And we're not prepared to do it without, you know, those conditions. And I said, well, I've never had any sinus problem, and that's true to this day. Nothing. I've never ever had sinusitis. I've never had when I get a cold, I'll maybe get a little bit of congestion at the top of my nose behind my eyes. I never have any problems with my sinuses. Yet, after I had this procedure, like literally days after I had this procedure, I was blowing my nose in the toilet, and this implant came down through my nose. My reaction was, I looked at him, despite having gone through months of, like, you know, real anxiety and trauma, trying to get them to, you know, take me seriously and give me this, you know, procedure. It didn't register what I was looking at in my hand. I kind of thought, what's that? I've got a grain of rice in my hand. What's that? Attached to this mucus and what's that? You know? And I thought, ew. And I scuffled it up in the tissue and I put it down the toilet and I flushed it. And it was a good 10 minutes after I got back into my bedroom and I realised what I'd done. And the first thing I did was go over and see Bea, Bridget Grant. And she was very understanding and very sympathetic. And she said, this has happened to other abductees. They may have something in them that's kind of designed to kind of sedate you slightly, so you don't put together and you don't. And she said, even people who have had their implants extracted and put them away safe under lock and key in a little matchbox in a cupboard, you know, locked up, everything, have gone back and to find those implants missing. So she said they obviously are able to collect them. If they can take us aboard craft at however many, you know, hundreds of yards above the earth, they can certainly nip down and like remove an implant from a matchbox. That's going to be no bother to them. So she was very understanding, and she said, don't worry about it, I expect they'll replace it. But I was disgusted. I was really horrified at that. And what, they'll take it out of a piece of drain pipe, because I flushed this down the toilet, but don't forget. You know, what, they could just retrieve that, and if you say, well, they'll put another one in, I expect.
Yeah.
You know, so I saw that, and 10 days after that happened, I was in the toilet again, and my daughter was having a shower. I blew my nose, and the entire contents were so immersed. Well, actually, it was Jonathan Downs told me this, because he trained to be a nurse. He was a fully qualified nurse before he got into cryptozoology. And he was one of the people I saw immediately after this happened, and he said that's impossible. It's impossible. Well, it obviously wasn't impossible because it happened, you know. But he said it is practically impossible for something like that. He said from your description of it, because it was like lemon curd, only it was a sort of slightly limey green colour, very viscous, lots of it, covering, you know, the whole of the tissue, absolutely masses of this in the tissue. I made this, you know, this involuntary noise. God, what's that? You know, and my daughter poked her head out from round the shower curtain, you know, what's up? And I said, this has just all come down my nose. And she looked at it and said, oh, that's disgusting. She said, God, what's that? You know. I said, I don't know, but it's horrible. And I said, again, I scrumpled the whole thing up. I just wanted to get rid of it and threw it down the toilet and flushed it away. And it was another 5 or 10 minutes before I realised what I'd done. Luckily, thankfully, my daughter saw it. And when I was describing this to Jonathan Downs, he said, that sounds like the contents of the sinus cavity. But you wouldn't normally ever get your sinus bursting to that degree unless you'd experience like massive problems, absolutely massive problems throughout your life. It's unheard of. It's unheard of the contents of the sinus cavity to rupture and empty like that. So, yes, quite extreme.
You know, it was strange. Hold on a second. I was wearing a headset so I could hear you better, but I hear myself when I'm talking. It's kind of weird. You know, I was thinking when you were talking about your sinuses, because sinuses problems are a common thing amongst a lot of contactees.
So I heard, but yeah.
Yeah, well, when I was younger, you know, 30 years ago, 25 years ago, when I first got in the field, nosebleeds were quite common. I mean, probably one in every three contactees had them, but for some reason, in the last 10, 15 years, it's really, really, it's not unheard of, but it's really, really, really rare. But the sinus thing is still, even now, a problem. And I know in the early days they would find implants usually in the left sinus, but not always. But all of that stuff pretty much has ceased now. It's kind of weird. But ET, it makes sense to me. I know it's hard for the contactees to understand, but it makes sense to me. Their technology progresses just like our technology progresses. Actually, theirs progresses faster than ours does. But still, their technology is progressing, and they are adjusting.
I don't think
to
it's that.
Huh?
I don't think it's that, Jay. I think that they've had exactly the same technology all along, and it's just they've gone into a different phase, so therefore we're experiencing a different phase. Now, for one thing, I don't think the Zetas are abducting people in the same numbers that they were originally. And it's partly because they've been offered a deal by other ETs, if you like, to rehome them, because the only reason that they're here in the first place is they had a big disaster with their own planet. They kind of wrecked their own planet from not knowing how to time travel properly, because this is something you've got to understand, is that no ETs that have made it here from other galaxies have done so other than by time traveling. There are two different types of time travel. There's time travel within the galaxy itself, and there's time travel to step into other universes or dimensions, and that's two different types of time travel. Now, Nevita's were attempting to get to the Kinnas like into other dimensions and into other universes. So that was as far as they got. So they're a relatively young race, sort of undeveloped, relatively speaking, compared to some of the other ETs. But they've never not been supervised by these other ETs, ETs like the Andromedans or the Drakon or the Anunnaki, and it's the Anunnaki that we're involved with, because these two tall light beings, this is the reason why the Anunnaki used to be called Shining Ones. They've got that much light emanating from them. You know, that's how they've got their name. It may even be where the whole thing to do with halos has come from, because they've had their input in our society for millions of years. We're not talking thousands, we're talking millions. So they have always had this technology, and they've always had some oversay over the Zetas as well. The Zetas are quite a controlled race. As well as them controlling us, they are being controlled by higher Zetas. Now this, me and my daughter know, because of having had a lot explained to us, and my daughter is allowed to consciously interact with them on board the craft that we're taking on. We're always taking on the same craft, and I'm not allowed to, although she says I am brought to consciousness there, they're operating in another dimension. They've completely mastered this second form of time travel, where they can go into other dimensions. And so I'm brought to consciousness, and she even has told me certain things that have happened to me on the craft, and certain things that I have consciously been doing on the craft as well, up there. But I can't bring the memory back with me now, but she can. She is allowed to interact with them, and this is how I know that they're time traveling, because they frequently... Well, I don't know if it's frequently, but regularly. They regularly sit her down in front of screens on board the craft. And this craft, she says, is about 2 to 3 miles wide. It's shaped like a chevron boomerang. And it doesn't belong to the Anunnaki. It belongs to associated hybrids. And she says that these hybrids once lived on Venus. There's always been a connection between Venus and Nibiru, and the Anunnaki anyway, she said, for millions of years. This was before Venus lost its atmosphere, she said. When Venus lost its atmosphere, the Venusians had to find their own way of kind of repairing their, you know, DNA and surviving away from their planet, so they had these huge crafts. But she says even this craft that we're taking on is small, compared to the smallest one of the Anunnaki ones, because sometimes the Anunnaki come and dock alongside, and they will, the Anunnaki will come on board. There are several different types of species. It's almost starting to feel like they're, you know, a Noah's Ark up there, according to my daughter, the amount of different species that she's aware of. She says when the Anunnaki come on board this Venusian hybrid craft that we're always taking on, but it's under the orchestration of the Anunnaki, they're not orchestrating our takings, the Anunnaki are. And she says she's seen them when they come on board, and the same thing that happened to me, do you remember I told you that I had to have this helmet put over my head? She said that they told me, the Anunnaki themselves told me this, you know, sort of in 1993. They told me that I couldn't look at them directly without a protective covering, because if I had looked at them, if they were coming through that door, all that light emanating from, if I'd looked at them directly, they said it would have burnt out my kundalini and I would have just died. So everybody has to have protection for looking at the Anunnaki. My daughter says this is the reason that the Zeta wear the goggles that they do. Because even the ones that aren't, those aren't their eyes. Those big slanty, you know, effects are not their eyes. Many abductees actually have said that they can see something behind them. As if, you know, the eye itself is actually behind these big slanty eyes. And in fact, they are visors. Now, don't ask me how they work, or they're probably semi-biological, if you know what I mean. They're probably a type of, there's a new thing out now that's called spray on skin. It's proving really fantastic for like burns patients, you know, sort of having to have layers of this artificial skin stretched over the wounds. They've managed to kind of like mix the, you know, the DNA and the skin essence, or, you know, with some fluid that they can now spray onto the skin. And it may well be that there's some biological thing going on there for the Zeta to create these goggles. But they're not eyes, Joe. I know this for a fact. They're not eyes. They're goggles. And my daughter says it's because even the ones not working for the Anunnaki, and there's so many different kind of allegiances and contentions, and they don't all get on with each other, and it's pretty much like human beings, actually. There are some, you know, really beneficent ones, and there are, you know, some warlike and aggressive ones. And she said that even the ones that are not working with the Anunnaki, which a lot of them have been, can't afford to be surprised unexpectedly by an Anunnaki without these goggles on, because it would just kill him. And on board the craft we are taking on, she says they have their own special quarters that has got it's a semi-clear screen, so you can see through it. It might be slightly sort of smoked, I think she was saying, but it's clear. It's, you know, you can see right through it. But they have to go into these quarters and be completely contained within them before anybody can see them at all, because to look at them with a naked eye would kill you. She says she's watched them, these particular ones, and I've since discovered that right at the beginning, if you remember me telling you when I was you know, a baby and a child, all the dreams I had of another planet,
yeah,
I've since been told by both the ETs and my daughter that that planet is Nibiru, and that's where I came from originally. And that's probably got, you know, the biggest part reason for why I'm being interacted with by them now. That I had some connection with them in other lives. And I'm pretty aware that this is the case because of all these other dreams to do with Samaria too. So anyway, she's watched them. She takes them in food sometimes. I haven't got around to asking her what it is that they eat. I think it's kind of like mushroom-based. But anyway, I'm not going to go into that now because I don't know. I don't want to talk about things that I don't know. I'd rather stick to what, you know, I've been told and I'm sure of. She says that the Anunnaki from Nibiru, because again, there are different types of hybrids within the species itself, are essentially kind of flying snakes. She's watched them on several occasions shapeshifting. They shapeshift between this form of like a snake with wings, and then this very tall humanoid version, which is the only one that I've seen, you know, the 7 foot, very light emanating, tall-headed, massively tall-headed humanoid. And she says they also have an angel presentation, just as we would imagine an angel to be, you know, sort of like with hair and the wings and everything. And she's watched them shapeshift backwards and forwards, shimmer, effortlessly, she says. She says it's effortless for them. And these are, she said to me that these are three actual presentations of the same person. It's not visual perception, because the Vita are really skilled at that. You know, perceptual interference, they can make you see something that isn't actually there, like screen memories. She says this isn't like that at all. She says they've been hybridized to the point where, like a chameleon, we wouldn't necessarily believe that a chameleon can do what it does unless you see it. But because she's seen this happen, she's telling me, yes, they can do that, Mum. They actually have these three different aspects to the one personality. The soul is the same, the one soul, but three presentations. And so they shift, and she said within a minute, they can be a snake, tall humanoid, angel. Snake, tall humanoid, angel. And they just shimmer backwards and forwards and all this light emanating off them, you know?
Well, we got about 3 or 4 minutes left. A quick two while I'm thinking about this. What's your eye color? You know I'm going to add this to my collection.
What's my eye color?
Wait, no, I was asking what your eye color was. What color are your eyes?
Blue. Green.
Oh, green. Okay. Well, you know, can I ask you what blood type you have? Because I've been typing contact beads for about 3 years now. I'm trying to get them all in the database.
Okay, right. Okay. Well, you know, I'm an abductee, Joe. I'm not a contactee.
Oh, abductee, same thing.
I mean,
anybody who's been taken by an alien, anybody who's been taken by an alien, I'm typing their blood. Abductees, contactees,
okay.
A whole
bunch of them. We can carry on this kind of like for a while. I'm typical Celtic, and in fact, this is another reason that I believe, you know, has been incorporated into my ancestry, if you like, because my family tree, my mum did this when I was sort of fairly young, and I've got a copy of how far she got back, you know, in the other room here, and like, we go back to quite a famous Scottish clan, but it goes straight back through, like, Kennedy's. And the Armstrongs, and I'm actually related to Mary, Queen of Scots, and Alexander the Great, if you take it back a few more generations. So, it's all this Scottish, Celtic, you know, ancestry. So I had, like, sandy, reddish, blondy hair when I was younger. It's darker now, but typical white, glowy white, you know, like, first time we get out in the sunlight, you know, today it's been such a beautiful day, but, you know, my skin looks like this is underbelly, you know, that kind of silvery mottled look, you know, like you've been hugging the fire too long, that horrendous speckly white. So, yeah.
Well, yeah, that's not uncommon. I know a lot of with that type of ancestry, and they usually are kind of redheaded and white. I mean, like, you can white. Do not
get
naked.
You look like you might have a bit of it yourself, Joe. You look like you might have a little bit of that ancestry.
Look, my legs, look, if I'm in shorts and it's nighttime outside, you can see me coming from miles. Honestly, my legs are like unbelievably white. But see, I'm a mutt. I can trace back 7 or 8 ancestries. I can trace some of them all the way back to royalty. I can also trace some of them all the way back to some bad parts of Italy, too. So, you know, I'm definitely a mutt.
Wait, Italy, did you
it's
say?
It's one of them things. But it's, we got like about a minute and a half, 2 minutes. So, quick, anything you want to say, anything you want to get across before we get out of here? Because, we're actually going to run over here in a minute. But anything particular, something that's in your grow, you just want to drop
yeah,
out right
quick? I think there is, too. I mean, what I'd like to say is that although people may have been lulled into this false sense of security now because their interactions appear to be less. It doesn't mean to say that it isn't still going on. It could be going on in another dimension with another big part of our soul, if you know what I mean. And also, just because the Vitas are now being helped by some of the, you know, the hierarchy, the guardian ETs to rehome them, because they realize what a problem this is. That they are taking over our entire culture. They're behind our entire technological upsurge. Ever since, you know, sort of the industrial, they arrived here. The Reapers arrived here. This is what you've got to understand here. They arrived here 260 years ago and kick-started our industrial revolution. So everything that we have got at the moment doesn't actually come from humanity this time round. Doesn't mean to say that humanity hasn't had this technology in the past, because we have. Back, you know, in the Mayan and Inca days, you know, sort of humanity itself is a far more long-lived and developed. Oh yes, I wanted to ask you, perhaps, you know, when we're off air, you could let me have the phone number of Whisper Radio in North Carolina. Do you remember I said to you I accidentally sort of tagged into them instead of your show the one time that I was trying to listen to it? I mean, because the chap who was speaking there was saying that they have found a human skeleton and a gold chain encapsulated in, like, gold seam. I think one was in Ohio and one was in California. But there's some, you know, where they can't do carbon dates. I didn't realise this, but you can only carbon date something up to 250,000 years old. But they've gone the further step. You have to use potassium or uranium or whatever it is. And these artifacts, this, I think they dated at 300 million years old. So this is how old humanity is. We're not talking thousands of years here. We're talking millions. This has been ongoing for humanity for millions of years. We've just had our memory erased. We've had our DNA disconnected. What we think of as our junk DNA, it's not junk. That's not junk. It's been deliberately disconnected. So by disconnecting aspects of our DNA and using mind control techniques, they are making us minimalise what is happening to us. And I actually believe that encouraging us to use terminology that is a little bit vague and, you know, doesn't get the message across to other people is part of it. Because I know that if this hadn't happened to me, then somebody saying that they were an experiencer to me would mean nothing. I think, oh, you know, we're all experiences. Everybody experiences things in life. What does that mean? You know, you're a contactee. Great. What does that mean? What, you're channeling somebody? You know, when you use the term abductee, there's no mistake about it. Whatever people want to think of you, and I know what people have got because they've been scared and they've run away, you know, lots of people I've never seen again. You know, but at least I'm being really to the point with them. And there's no mistaking what I'm saying to them. They can't misunderstand that. I am being taken, and or was taken, without my prior knowledge or remembered consent, and having implants put in me and procedures performed on me, I am an abductee. And so, yeah, thank you for giving me that last minute to really make me
That's okay.
That point home.
Yeah, that's okay. We're gonna get out of here now because I know we're actually over the limit. But Helen, thanks for coming on. You were great. I had a great time.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, sir. It's lovely hearing your voice, mate. Nice one.
I keep seeing people popping in the room. But again, it was great, guys and girls. We're gonna get out of here, everybody. This will rebroadcast on Wednesday night on its usual time, 7 to 9 p.m. The archive will be available immediately following the program. I won't post the archive until after it airs live on Wednesday night, or actually in its regular spot on Wednesday night. Until then, guys, have some fun. Enjoy your lives. Smile. Oh, following week is, I'm losing it. I should have had it in front of me. Well, I'll have to look and see. I'm sorry. Oh, it's Sasha. Oh, man, I'm losing. Anyway, y'all know who it is. Go look on the schedule, www.ufo1thecover.com. It's listed right there. Until next week, have some fun, people. Enjoy it. It's Sasha Christie. I'll see y'all next week. Good night, everybody.
Patrice Sheridan, host of A Global Focus. Broadcasts resume Friday nights from 10 to 12 Eastern on the Paranormal Radio Network. Come join the discussion.